Okay, thanks everybody. So the agenda for today's webinar is we're gonna provide a little background of our special guest, Dr. Miranda. And then our special guest will address those questions that were pre-submitted. And then last, we'll have an opportunity for those who are attending today to ask questions in like the last like 10, maybe 15 minutes of this webinar. And during that time, we will turn off the recording and that can be not recorded. And throughout, if you have questions, you're welcome to put them in the chat, or if you have a raise hand, like you can do the raise hand function if you have a question, and we can either address it at the time or preferred at the end. So this first part is introducing Dr. Michelle Miranda, who is an assistant professor at the University of Utah Department of Neurology, Division of Neuropsychology. She developed the first fully Spanish-speaking service in neuropsychology at the University of Utah, and she also provides pre-surgical evaluations for patients with epilepsy. Her career special interests include cross-cultural neuropsychology, bilingualism in epilepsy, WADA evaluations for non-English speakers, and mapping of language function. She's passionate about the role of a neuropsychologist as an advocate, and thus is a co-author of the Hispanic Neuropsychological Association's Social Justice and Advocacy Committee. And she is also the chair of the Utah Psychological Association, or UPA's, Diversity Committee. Thank you so much, Dr. Michelle Miranda, for being here today.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you for the invitation. I really appreciate it. I like that this is a small group because we can chat a little bit more. You all can ask your questions. And so this can be a little bit more intimate, which I appreciate. So happy to be here.
Awesome. Well, now we will dive into the pre-submitted questions and I'm going to turn it over to Wing.
Yeah, thanks so much for having us today, Dr. Miranda. These questions were submitted by several different students, and so hopefully we can get to all of them and kind of access your knowledge around the ECCC. A lot of folks highly recommended you for this, and so we're really excited to hear what you have to say yes. about some of these things. and so the first question here is a little bit about maybe what are some of the resources that you're aware of that can help a student study for the ECCC?
Yeah, so can we, is it okay if we go sort of a little bit in order? So mm-hmm. can I first talk about the ECCC? Is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay, so just so we're all sort of on the same page as we like go along with the questions. And so it sounds like some of you have not even started looking into this. So just so that we're kind of have the foundation. And so I wrote myself a couple notes here, but so the ECCC is basically our licensure exam. And so it is required. So if you're going to see patients, it is required that you get licensed. And it is made up of 225 questions. They're all multiple choice questions. And you get 4 hours and 15 minutes to complete the test. And so what you'll do, you'll register first for the test. And when you are able to register depends on a lot of things that we can talk about later, but you'll register for the test, you'll go into a specific facility to take the test, and then your passing score actually varies by state. So each state has a different cutoff for what a passing score is. Generally speaking, it's 70% that you have to get correct, which is a passing score of 500. So you need to get at least a score of 500 on your test. So and that's general. That's not in all states. Some they fluctuate, so a little bit. So that's what we sort of need. It's 225 questions, 4 hours, 15 minutes, and you need to get at least a passing score of 500 on your test to pass. Now, in order to register for this test, you do need to pay a fee. This is okay, so me from a social justice perspective, I have issues with all of this because it is super, super expensive, but the actual exam fee is $450, but they add on all kinds of other fees to that. So first, there could be an administrative fee based on not just the state, but also based on the facility where you're going. And then there's an extra $65 fee for the actual testing center to schedule your tests. So it varies a little bit by state where you take the test. But so I took my test. I was doing my postdoc. That's where I took my ECCC. I was in Florida at the time, and I ended up paying $687 for the test.
Ooh.
So yes. So so do not fail, because you'll have to pay again. And that's something that's, a problem. And I think I have issues with this because sort of as students and then trainees, we basically have to pay for everything, right? Like we got to pay for our applications just to apply to something. You got to pay, you know, any moving fees that are associated with that, going to conferences, you have to pay, and even to get licensed, you have to pay. So, I wish there was a better process for this because it's not fair for a lot of students. So, but this is sort of generally where we at. So it's about $680 to register to take this test. So I think we have sort of the overall, like what the test is. And so Wayne, remind me again, the first question you asked.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I guess I want to reflect that. It sounds like you're saying that students have to have a lot of intentionality in terms of saving up for the test financially, and then also right allocating time to study, and then also being very specific in terms of where you might want to take this, depending on where you are in your clinical journey. Is that correct, Dr. Miranda?
Exactly. Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Yeah, and so the question was maybe around that second part in terms of like studying or like what resources maybe you tapped into in order to make sure that you can take the test once, and kind of get it done with. If possible. So yeah, what are some resources you found particularly helpful for this test?
Yeah, so in terms of studying, obviously this is really important. And so generally the rule of thumb is to study about 4 months before the test. And so everything that I looked at, because I looked into this, says different times. It could be as short as 3 months before your test, or as much as 6 months, but anything over 6 months is not recommended because you start losing information. So maybe the information that you studied in the beginning, you know, you sort of might forget that over time. And so after 6 months is not recommended, but you do have to set some time every day, you know, for studying during this time. And a good rule of thumb is to actually schedule your test at some point, because that is like incentive that drives you to actually study. So maybe scheduling it out 5 months in advance so that you have the date set so that you actually sit and study, because if you don't have a date, it's very easy to sort of keep putting it off. But in terms of resources, so there are quite a few. And so the best resources are sort of these packages. So these study packages that you can purchase. So AATBS has so all of these programs that I'm going to talk about, they have all kinds of different packages. I can tell you, so AATBS is kind of the more popular one, is actually the one that APA talks a little bit more about. And that is actually the one that I personally used. And it actually was fantastic. So they allow for instruction. So you can either take a package with some one-to-one instruction, or you can do a self-study exam package, which is what I did because I didn't have the time to attend classes. So I did a self-study package, and that gives you, so it's 9 months access. And what you get is you get books, you get a bunch of books that you have to go over, and then you get a lot of notes. You get like these PowerPoint notes, you get flashcards that are really useful. And then you get a bunch of practice tests. I don't remember how many, it was 8 practice tests that you get. So that's all you get. And that costs $1,239.
So that makes me just like cringe.
Yes. So this is obviously not, in terms of equity, this is not equitable. It's just, I mean, how do you pay for this and register for your test? I mean, this is crazy. But it's worth, like what Wynn was mentioning about the intentionality is like you do have to start saving early because I took my test when I was a postdoc, meaning that I was no longer in school, meaning that I was no longer getting loans. So that was super, super hard on me. But if you sort of, you know, maybe when you're a student, maybe when you're getting, you have some loan money, maybe some loan assistance, some grants that can help you with this, that, you know, you start saving then. That's AATBS. Then there's also Academic Review has a program. You can choose a 30-day full program. The 30-day program is $329. The 90-day full program is $679. And then it's also, you get a lot of stuff with that. You get practice tests, you get a lot of material that you can read. So that's the Academic Review. The Psych Prep also has a program. They have, so they send you study materials and then you get online tests. That's $750. Or if you want everything digitally, it's $700. So they take off $50 there. So those are sort of the bigger ones. There are other programs that are available, but those are sort of the bigger resources. Because this is so much money, I always feel like we should be helping each other out. And so one of the things is if you know someone who took, who already took the test and has the materials, if there's a way to either borrow those materials or pay sort of like a half, you know, pay for half of what they paid for the materials, you know, and sort of do it that way where you're helping them because they get half of the money back, but you're also getting a discounted fee. And so if there's a way to do that, or if there's someone who's willing to just give you some old material, that could be super, super helpful. I really feel like it's important to maybe create some kind of a database, something that we can all like, it's like a test bank of some sort or a resource bank where we can all like any materials that we have, you know, we can share, because that just makes it easier for students and trainees. If we could just sort of all like share all of this. And I think, so Keely and Wing can talk to us a little bit more about some of those ideas. But I have some information already. So I do have some resources that I saved. Unfortunately, I didn't save everything, but I have some things. And so maybe we can, if we get that started, I can start sharing what I have already. And then we can just like share it amongst ourselves.
And that's been approved by UPA initially so far. And so we're talking with the board about developing a storage or that resource bank for student members only. If you're interested, we'll be sending out an announcement about that maybe later this semester once we're able to figure it out, but it should be able to be accessed on the UPA website. So.
Nice. Yeah. So I could get that started. I have some information.
Yeah. And so what I guess I'm hearing from that is you know, a lot of like preparation, a lot of difficult choices in terms of where you might go to for your study materials. And the last question I'm kind of like pondering here from the pre-generated questions was this question around when to take the ECCC. And it sounds like for you, Dr. Miranda, that choice was in your postdoc, and you're kind of reflecting maybe how it could have been more financially accessible, right, if you were still attached to a graduate program. I'm wondering if you might offer some advice in terms of when someone might want to take it, like a cost-benefit analysis for their career.
Yeah, so there's a lot of factors that you have to think about when you're making this decision. So for me, one of the things was I did not know where I was going to end up. I had been to a few different states in my training, and I didn't know where I was going to get hired. So that matters, right? Because you need to register for that in the state, right? And then there are specific state requirements. So I wanted to wait, one, for that reason, right? Because I didn't know where I was going to end up. But two, because I also wanted to just focus on my training. I didn't want to be distracted by all the studying that I knew needed to happen. So I wanted to just like, my focus was getting all the training possible. And I felt a little bit more comfortable taking that time during postdoc because I felt a little bit more comfortable with what I was doing, being a little bit more independent. And so that's when I decided I'm ready to start studying for this. So it just depends on where you are. And then also another thing to consider is if you already know where you want to work. So you say, let's say you're a student, you know the state that you want to end up in. So let's say Utah is home. This is where your family is, and you want to come back to Utah. You want to study, you want to work in Utah. Well, some states like Utah right now, the policy is that you cannot take your ECCC while you're a student. So you cannot take it while you're in grad school. That you would have to wait until postdoc to take it. Other states are not the same, do not have the same policy. So I'll give you the example of California. California, you can take the ECCC as a student. And actually in some universities in California, they actually require it. So it's actually, instead of doing comps, they do the ECCC. So their students graduate already having passed the ECCC, which is super great because when you're in grad school, you're sort of studying all the material that is already in the ECCC. And so that's super helpful because the material is all fresh. If you study later on, it's sort of, you have to sort of all everything that you already learned, you have to sort of go back to all of that information. And so it makes it a little bit harder. But these are sort of all of these variables that you need to think about when you make your decision on when you want to do it. And it sounds like, you know, because we're on the UPA board, it sounds like the law in Utah might change. And it sounds like they might allow students to take the test before they graduate. If that happens, that would be super great if you could do that, because you have a little bit more financial resource as a student, and you're also already going over all of this material, so it might behoove you to take it as a student, but you need to know what state you will be working in.
Yeah, and some university programs, I think our school psych program at the U kind of offer like a buffer money for like continued education. And so I think there are some funds in the different programs, and you can talk with your admin if this does get passed of like, hey, can I use some of this funding, or is there allocated funding for this licensure? And that might be something to help out.
Absolutely. Yeah, you need to, any help you can get, it's worthwhile, yeah. Did I fully answer that question?
Yes, okay. I think you did, yeah. In terms of what I'm hearing from you is saying that like it really depends on like what makes sense for you in terms of, or I guess what I'm reflecting is like you have to make choices, right? In terms of like, do I want to get fully immersed in my internship and postdoc experience? Or do I want to, you know, maybe take it a little bit earlier, knowing that I have some support, while also considering like, what does your state say? Or what is the state you want to move to eventually say about the ECCCP? And so a lot of difficult choices there, I think, but there are places to get help, it also sounds like.
Yes.
I want to pass it over to Keely then for some of the remaining questions. I know you've covered a lot of ground actually in terms of what we have, so I'm looking forward to the Q&A.
Yeah, you've covered a lot of ground. Thank you, Dr. Miranda. One of the questions was like, does it matter which state you take the ECCCP in? And that's already been addressed, but I wonder if there are any other, or if you know the other requirements outside of maybe the scores that differ for licensure in each state. So the score for the ECCCP differs, but what other requirements might be different for like the ECCCP and licensure across the states?
One of the things is a score that varies by state, but also when you take the test, right? When you are allowed to take the test also varies by state. I think that's it. But in terms of which state you take it in, you can take it in any state. So there are ECCCP locations nationwide, and you can take it in. So for example, I was in Florida, but I knew that I was going to be working in Utah. So I took my test in Florida, but I registered through, the registration actually happens through, I'm forgetting the name now. Let me see, I had it here somewhere. The Association of State and Provincial Psychology Boards, ASPPB, that's where you register for the ECCCP. And that is like sort of the one time, like a one thing, sort of like a national thing. So you would only have to register there. And then after the ECCCP, there's that question of the law and ethics exam, which is a whole other thing and another payment that you have to make, another thing that you have to study for. And that is super different. So the law and ethics exam that you take is super different by state. The content is different, obviously, because there are different laws in every state, but then also, how you take the test, if that makes sense. So for example, the law and ethics exam for the state of Utah is actually an open book exam. That is not the case in every state. California does not allow open book. So things like that, it'll differ. But the law and ethics exam is the one that is super different across all states. But like I said, the ECCCP, you can take that anywhere. The law and ethics exam also, you can take that anywhere, any testing facility. You just need to know, obviously, like which state you're going to be practicing in, which state you want to be licensed in.
Gotcha. And then the next question would be, do we really need the ECCCP qualification? And I know you'd mentioned before, like if you're going to see patients, it's required.
So if you're going to see patients in a provider capacity, then yes, it is required. So if you're going to be providing any kind of service, any clinical service to patients, it is required. However, if you're only going to be doing research. So if that's, if you're not, you know, you don't want to see, you don't want to do any clinical work, you only want to focus on research, you don't have to be licensed to do that.
Even if it's like applied research, like you're working with patients, you don't have to be licensed.
No. So, because you're not like, you're not billing, you're not, there's no, it's different. A lot of differences. So it's more like you have to consent with IRB and things like that, but you don't, and still you, of course, like you have to follow HIPAA, but it's a different rule. So like, for example, here at the University of Utah, we have a lot of people who are researchers. They only do research and they do see patients through research, and they are not licensed.
Okay. So sounds like it's also variable and just maybe where you want to go, research or clinical. But if you're providing clinical services, then yes, you're definitely going to need the license.
And there are also differences about, so there are requirements in terms of what program you're in also, because, so I think counseling is an acceptable program, but then someone did their PhD in like cognitive, like neuroscience. And then they could not sit for the ECCP. They had to do a whole, because the PhD, so that the PhD that you get matters also. It's not just anyone can sit for the ECCP. You have to have a certain PhD program that you were in.
Gotcha. Okay. And then one of the last questions pre-submitted was like, what are the statistics on pass rates, like across psychology fields, who can sit for it? And if you know those.
Oh my gosh. So the pass rates. So this is actually super, super interesting. The research on this, and for me, super disturbing. I will tell you why. So I made myself some notes here. So okay. So the first study that came out of the ECCP was from New York. So they took everyone that had taken the ECCP in New York. They looked at demographic information, and then they saw what, who was passing, right, the ECCP. And so in New York, it looked like Black and Hispanic applicants were failing at much higher rates than Asian and white applicants. And then men were failing more often than women. And then also students that were in PsyD programs were failing more than people in PhD programs. So that was some of it. So what they did was they were like, well, but maybe that's specific to New York. What if we do this study in another state? And so they replicated the same study in Connecticut. And Connecticut basically found the same results. So there were similar results in terms of ethnicity. So Black and Hispanic students were still failing at much larger rates. So Blacks, it was like 23% failing, Hispanic 18%, whites only 5%, and Asians 3% were failing. So it was sort of similar to before, but for them, gender did not have the same significance. So men and women did not differ, actually. It was not statistically significant, but they found the same thing about PsyDs versus PhDs, and PsyDs were failing at much higher rate at 14, 15% versus PhDs who were failing at a 5% rate. But then more so interestingly, so these studies sort of continued, and there were other studies that they had. And so this other study looked at other factors. So not just demographic for the actual applicant, for the student, but information on programs. So what they did here is their hypothesis was that ECCP performance would be associated with your program prestige, the program selectivity rate, so in terms of admission rates, and student factor sort of predating graduate training. For example, level of intelligence, level of motivation, standardized taking ability as approximated by GRE scores. And so that's what they looked at. And so basically, as they predicted, the ECCC was actually significantly correlated with the three sets of variables that they found. So the strongest associations were found with higher GRE scores. So the higher, so that's test-taking ability. So standardized test-taking ability. If you're good at standardized testing, you got a good GRE score, more likely to pass ECCC. Also, to students that were in colleges that had lower admission rates were more likely to pass the ECCC. Students that were in colleges that were better rated, meaning the US News and World Report scores, you know how they sort of score, like rate colleges. So the better the college that you're going to, more likely that you are to pass the ECCC. And then if your program has a greater emphasis on research, you're also more likely to pass the ECCC. And then interestingly, they found a negative correlation between ECCC performance and then the percentage of minority students in the program. And that basically means higher ECCC scores were associated with lower percentages of minority students in programs. I mean, what?
Wow. Yeah.
and all these studies are sort of consistently, you know, this test is not equitable. The recommendations are we need to take a serious, hard look at the validity of this test because, you know, obviously it's not fair. It's not fair for everyone. So it's just like, this is really super interesting information, but again, which is why I have issues with this test, personal and professional issues with the ECCC.
Wow. Yeah, those are fascinating and just terrible statistics. So you're saying that there are some discussions happening around the ECCC. Are they moving discussions? Are they moving forward with things, or are we going to be seeing some changes, or not for a long time, you think?
I don't know that we're going to be seeing any changes anytime soon. The problem is that, you know, so the people that are passing the test are fine with it, obviously. So that means the people in the higher up, the people creating this test, that people generally think this is a valid test, right? Despite this information. So I don't know. I think that there, what would need to happen is there would need to be a lot more pressure on these institutions, not only the people who create the test, but also the people who require the test. There would need to be a lot of advocacy around this. And there's just not enough minority students, because they're the ones that get affected the most. There are not enough minority students to really make some waves. So that would mean that we would need allies to sort of step up and sort of bring these issues to the forefront. So no changes anytime soon, but you know, it's obviously, this is a problem.
And if people listening are interested in getting involved in advocating or just being more aware of opportunities to advocate, like where might they look or who should they talk to? Because it is important.
Yeah, that's a good question. I have not heard about any of these movements personally. I don't know, but given that, you know, we have a diversity committee with UPA, you know, that's something that we could look into also and figure out how we can advocate for this. So if there is interest, there are ways to do this. And so, you know, given that I'm on the diversity committee, that's something, that's a platform we could use to do this.
Awesome. That's good to know. And we'll be sharing Dr. Miranda's contact information to those who signed up for the webinar. So if you are interested in getting involved with the diversity committee, or just want to know more about EPPP equity, then you can reach out to her. But those are all the questions that we had that were pre-submitted. And now I'm gonna turn off the recording. I'm gonna end the official webinar, and we'll open it up to just Q&A from the attendees today.